Encyclical letter Magnifica Humanitas of Pope Leo XIV on safeguarding the human person in the time of artificial intelligence. Chapter 5, The Culture of Power and the Civilization of Love. Paragraph 182. Having considered how AI is transforming certain aspects of life and society, and particularly the serious implications for human dignity, we must now turn our attention to the yet more tragic issue of war. Here the question is not merely the efficiency of new tools, but also the risk that technology, detached from ethics and responsibility, will render decisions about life and death more rapid and impersonal, and will present the use of force as an immediate and viable option. In an increasingly interdependent world, peace is not simply one issue among others, but a prerequisite for the universal common good and a test of the moral maturity of peoples, especially of those who bear responsibility for governing. Paragraph 183. The digital revolution is changing the nature of conflict. Alongside conventional warfare, there are hybrid forms such as cyber attacks, information manipulation, campaigns of influence, and the automation of strategic decisions. AI acts as an accelerating factor in these processes, particularly within a context where many technologies are intrinsically ambivalent. Consequently, what is created for defense can be rapidly repurposed for offense, and the fine line between protection and aggression becomes blurred. While AI can enhance the defense and protection of civilians, it can also lower the threshold for the use of force, shield people from responsibility, and foster a culture in which the enemy is reduced to a statistic and the victim to collateral damage. Faced with these transformations, we must recall the principles of social doctrine, the dignity of the person, the common good, the universal destination of goods, subsidiarity, solidarity, and justice, for they are criteria for judging whether technologies truly serve humanity or are subjugating it. We should therefore consider these principles as guidelines for our decision-making. Paragraph 184. In this chapter, therefore, I will compare two opposing approaches, which I have already evoked through biblical imagery in the introduction. On the one hand, there's the temptation of constructing the Tower of Babel, relying on power and pride. On the other hand, patience is required in order to rebuild Jerusalem piece by piece, as in the time of Nehemiah, by safeguarding humanity and the common good. Paragraph 185. If we examine global dynamics, we can recognize more clearly the spread of a culture of power characterized by polarization and violence. The modern Babel can be seen not only in the globalized technocratic paradigm, but also in the remote clash between opposing imperialisms, between powers that wish to preserve their supremacy, and those that aspire to seize that supremacy, resulting in a multiplicity of local conflicts. Moreover, there seems to be no limit to the race, driven by a dehumanizing ambition to develop ever more powerful technologies or to secure control over them. Yet, despite this downward spiral, we can also glimpse a great part of humanity that is striving to remain human and working to build the holy city of coexistence and peace. All too often, we're unwitting builders and clumsy architects of this city, capable of generous gestures but lacking an overall vision. This building project is slower, less visible, and less spectacular, and awaits a better understanding and greater coordination so that it may become the conscious and clear responsibility of every community, from families to states and the relations between nations. It's this prospect of commitment, this construction site of hope, that we call the civilization of love. The civilization of love in the digital age. Paragraph 186. When St. Paul VI coined the phrase, the civilization of love, the world was in the midst of the Cold War, an arms race, and severe economic instability. In that context, the Church proposed an alternative path to that of ideological opposition between systems, and envisioned a social order in which justice and charity are intertwined and love becomes the guiding principle of economic, political, and cultural life. Today we must resolutely recover this vision, for the civilization of love is no naive utopia, but a demanding project, which consists in translating charity into structures of justice, giving institutional form to fraternity, and regarding others, whether individuals or peoples, as allies necessary for building the common good. As the encyclical letter Fratelli Tutti reminded us, only this social love is capable of becoming a culture and a norm, and thereby of bringing about a stable international order, transforming mere armed coexistence into a community with a shared future. Paragraph 187. This insight proves even more fundamental in the current context of digital transformation. Digital networks, the globalized economy, and the development of AI create increasingly tighter bonds, linking in real time decisions made in one place to the effects they produce elsewhere. In this sense, the words of the Second Vatican Council on the growing interdependence between peoples remain timely, for the common good is taking on an increasingly universal dimension, with rights and duties concerning the entire human family. The project for a civilization of love, therefore, must undertake the task of transforming this imposed interdependence into a willed and chosen solidarity. This is the guiding principle for technological processes. It's not enough for artificial intelligence to make us more efficient or connected. It must also serve to build a universal human family with shared rights and duties, where digital proximity becomes a real opportunity for encounter and mutual care. The culture of power. Paragraph 188. In our time, a culture of power is taking hold, in which the availability of resources and the ability to dominate tend to dictate the agenda and criteria for decision-making. In this way, the common good of humanity is relegated to the background, and the concrete tragedy of peoples at war is reduced to a secondary consideration in relation to strategic interests. This culture of power infiltrates society, changes relationships and behaviors, and grows by normalizing war, pursuing ever greater military power, taking advantage of the crisis of multilateralism, and fueling a false realism that insists that there is no alternative. The normalization of war. Paragraph 189. In 1965, the words of St. Paul VI resounded powerfully at the UN General Assembly. Never again war. Never again war. We must acknowledge that, despite the desires and declarations for peace, the past 60 years have been marked by conflicts of astonishing brutality, often affecting civilian populations on a massive scale, leading to the death of innocent victims, mass displacement, social destabilization, and long-lasting wounds. Nevertheless, in public discourse, there was a widespread conviction that war should remain a last resort, subject to strict ethical and legal limits, and always oriented toward a political vision of peace. Following developments in the immediate post-First World War period, a turning point occurred after the Second World War. Peace was made the focus of the international order, as attested in particular by the United Nations Charter, with the intention to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. Likewise, many national constitutions restricted the use of force to extreme and strictly limited circumstances. Even during the Cold War, despite the existence of serious conflicts, there remained the awareness that a new world war had to be avoided at all costs. Paragraph 190. Today, however, we're witnessing a real paradigm shift in public discourse and in decisions regarding rearmament, with a troubling revival of war as an instrument of international politics, while the very ethical principles that had previously limited its use are being eroded. Regional conflicts that drag on over time, escalating tensions and reciprocal threats are becoming almost commonplace, and forms of conflict driven by the desire for territorial expansion that were thought to be overcome are reemerging. Public opinion is gradually being shaped and conditioned by polarizing media narratives, which are often amplified by algorithms that prioritize conflict and confrontation. Paragraph 191. We're also witnessing a disconcerting loss of historical memory, as firsthand accounts of the Holocaust and the two world wars are disappearing. This leads to a selective or distorted rewriting of the past in a context where fake news and the manipulation of narratives obscure the lessons that have been learned. Without a living memory of the horrors of war, political decisions risk being made on the basis of power alone, without any consideration for the long-term consequences. Paragraph 192. To all this, the media and digital dimensions are adding new and decisive elements. Communication networks, fragmented information environments, and algorithms that reward conflict can magnify polarization and resentment, increase propaganda, and make shared discernment more difficult. Thus, war is not only fought but also culturally conditioned through simplistic narratives, a friend or foe mentality, disinformation, and fear. When historical memory fades and the ethical principles that protect civilians and the most vulnerable are weakened, it becomes easier to justify violence as necessary, inevitable, or even sanitized. It's in this context that humanity is slipping into a violent culture of power, where peace no longer appears as a responsibility to be taken on, but as a fragile interval between conflicts. Today, more than ever, without prejudice to the right to self-defense in the strictest sense, it's important to reaffirm that the just war theory, which has all too often been used to justify any kind of war, is now outdated. Humanity possesses far more effective and capable tools for promoting human life and resolving conflicts, such as dialogue, diplomacy, and forgiveness. The use of force, violence, and weapons reflects a relational poverty that always has disastrous consequences for civilian populations. Force without limits. Paragraph 193. The growth of the military-industrial complex has become a defining feature of the current political landscape and has become a key sector in the economy of various countries. The close link between economic interests, the military apparatus, and political decisions produces an armed nation in which war appears as a natural extension of politics, and the arms market becomes an autonomous driving force behind military decisions. Nor can we ignore the enormous economic interests behind war. The armaments industry and countries that supply weapons profit from a market that thrives precisely on conflicts. In this sense, there are also financial interests that contribute to fueling tensions in various regions of the world. Paragraph 194. Military arsenals are receiving renewed attention, and the past recognition of the threat posed by weapons capable of destroying all of humanity had promoted paths toward détente and disarmament negotiations. Unfortunately, this approach has been left behind, and the evolution of nuclear arsenals, including the prospect of its tactical use, makes the use of such weapons seem less improbable. In this context, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which came into force in 2021 with the support of over 70 countries, is an important step. However, it risks remaining largely symbolic since the major nuclear powers have not agreed to it. This has led to the widespread yet erroneous belief that nuclear deterrence is an indispensable prerequisite for security. This has also contributed to a new arms race, which is hard to control, and accompanied by the gradual dismantling of nuclear reduction agreements, as well as the development of miniaturized weapons that make their use seem like a more viable option. Paragraph 195. The same logic applies to conventional warfare. Military force, weak diplomatic initiatives, and the complexity of the interests at stake contribute to conflicts that tend to become protracted, with extremely high human and environmental costs. It's much easier to start a war than to stop it, and yet discussion on conflict prevention remains tragically marginal. Paragraph 196. The situation is further destabilized by the presence of new armed operatives, such as jihadist groups, private militias, and criminal networks that mark the end of the state's monopoly on the use of force. Often these groups intertwine vague ideological motivations with concrete economic interests, transforming war into a way of life for entire generations of young people and children. Here the objective is no longer a definitive victory, but the perpetuation of conflict as a source of power and income. Weapons and artificial intelligence. Paragraph 197. The above-mentioned scenario is linked to the unceasing development of weapon systems, particularly those involving AI. The Holy See has recently observed that the growing ease with which autonomous weapons systems can be deployed makes war more feasible and less subject to human control. This violates the principle that armed force should be used only as a last resort in cases of legitimate self-defense. For this reason, the development and use of AI in warfare must be subject to the most rigorous ethical constraints to guarantee respect for human dignity and the sanctity of life and to avoid a race to develop such arms. Paragraph 198. Sometimes there is talk of artificial moral agents, as if machines were able to distinguish between right and wrong with greater consistency than a human being. Yet moral judgment cannot be reduced to calculation, for it involves conscience, personal responsibility, and the recognition of the other as a person. Therefore, it's not permissible to entrust lethal or otherwise irreversible decisions to artificial systems. No algorithm can make war morally acceptable. AI does not remove the intrinsic inhumanity of conflict. Indeed, it can only bring about conflict more quickly and render it more impersonal, lowering the threshold for resorting to violence, transforming defense into threat prediction, and thus reducing victims to data. In this way, it will accustom us to the idea that violence is inevitable and needs only to be optimized. This does not diminish the importance of instilling, as far as possible, values and sound judgment into the artificial systems we build, so that they can contribute to a moral ecosystem in which humans are better able to listen to their own consciences, as well as allowing AI models to establish appropriate boundaries. Paragraph 199. It's not enough to invoke a generic type of ethics. Concrete criteria for discernment must be established. The first such criterion concerns personal responsibility. When a decision to strike becomes automated or opaque, the risk of abdicating responsibility increases. For this reason, the chain of responsibility must be identifiable and verifiable. Those who design, train, authorize, and employ technology must be held accountable for their decisions. The second criterion pertains to the moral time frame for making judgments. While AI tends to expedite the decision-making processes, speed and efficiency should never be the supreme motivating force for the irreversible decisions made in the context of war. The third criterion is the identification and protection of civilians. Any technology that facilitates attacks without seeing the face of human beings lowers the moral threshold of conflict. Target selection and the use of force must not confuse combatants and non-combatants, nor ignore the impact on defenseless populations. Paragraph 200. These criteria give rise to certain non-negotiable requirements. First, all systems used in a war setting must guarantee the possibility of retracing and reconstructing decision-making processes so that accountability and blame are not collapsed into the machine. Second, the decision to use lethal force cannot be delegated to opaque or automated processes, but must remain under effective, self-aware, and responsible human control. Finally, it's imperative to establish a shared framework, also at the international level, in order to curb the technological arms race and ensure robust protection for civilians and the infrastructures necessary for their survival. The crisis of multilateralism. Paragraph 201. The culture of power also stems from the crisis of the multilateral system. The institutions established to safeguard the concept of a common future for all peoples and a global common good appear to have been weakened. This is due not only to structural limitations, but also to a frequent lack of shared will to support and reform them, or to recognize their moral authority. Instead of making progress, we're regressing from the significant turning point of the 20th century. After 1989, the collapse of communist regimes in Europe was followed by a predominantly economic globalization, which lacked an adequate political framework capable of sustaining dialogue and peace. An almost blind faith was placed in the ability of the markets to generate prosperity, democracy, and stability. In reality, rather than automatically generating unity and peace, globalization has provoked fundamentalist, identity-based, and nationalistic reactions. The result is a far cry from genuine multilateralism. Instead, what's appeared is a disorderly and conflict-ridden multipolarism with a prevailing sense of mistrust. Paragraph 202. What has also reemerged is the temptation to forge a collective identity in opposition to an enemy, fueled by narratives in which each party portrays itself as a victim, entitled to retribution. The reduction of complex issues into simplistic categories, me first, friend or foe, us or them, facilitates decisions that are often irresponsible and undermine mutual trust among nations. The force of international law is thus replaced by the claim that might makes right. Consequently, tribunals that are competent for settling disputes between states or dealing with war crimes are often weakened or bypassed, with devastating ramifications for political culture and social cohesion. Paragraph 203. In this context, peacebuilding has been relegated to a secondary role. Cooperation for development, disarmament, conflict prevention, and the establishment of mutual trust are neglected in the name of power politics. The achievements of humanitarian law are also compromised. Indeed, the principle of proportionality in responding to aggression, the protection of access to water, food, and essential goods, and respect for the lives of civilians, especially children, come to be regarded as naive relics of the past. A supposed political realism. Paragraph 204. We live at a time of significant spiritual and cultural blindness. A false pragmatism urges us to sever the roots of our history as if it were possible to inaugurate a kind of new creation detached from the past. Even those who cite important moral principles can fall into this historical nihilism, mistakenly believing that the atrocities of the 20th century can never happen again. Yet in reality, the same dynamics are reemerging under new guises. The mentality of armed equilibrium and deterrence appears to be reasserting itself. Today, however, in contrast to the two-sided dynamic of the Cold War, the proliferation of operatives and battlefields makes this mentality increasingly fragile. Escalating conflicts leads to asymmetric and hybrid wars, fought not only on the battleground but also on the economic, financial, and cyber fronts, where disinformation and campaigns that feed people's fears are used to manipulate public opinion. In many countries, including those in the global South, increased military spending is presented as the only response to an uncertain future or perceived threats. Meanwhile, the real cost falls on the poorest, who see resources for healthcare, education, and social services being reduced. Paragraph 205. At the core of these issues is a false realism, based not only on the prevailing mentality of force, but on the cultural and anthropological belief that war is an inevitable part of human nature. It's said that things have always been this way, except for occasional pauses, and that it will always be so. As a result, the concern is no longer the search for peace, which has been lost as a point of reference on the international stage, but rather how and when to take military action. This same argument maintains that it would be irresponsible not to prepare for conflict. I would argue, however, that what is truly irresponsible is realpolitik, the form of political realism that sows in consciences and in society an attitude of resignation to the inevitability of war, and dismisses peace and dialogue as utopian or irrational positions that ignore the risks at stake. In fact, peace is neither a naive hope nor merely the absence of war. Instead, it is always possible as the fruit of justice and charity. Paragraph 206. In such a climate, nihilism and pragmatism become intertwined and end up normalizing grave errors. Religious extremism and identity-based fanaticism ally themselves with irrational economic policies, while politics often turns to misinformation and ridiculing opponents, and systematically cultivating fears and resentments. Thus, diversity is increasingly perceived as a threat, which fuels a desire for possession, a will to dominate, hegemonic ambitions, abuses of power, and a fear of those who are different, thereby creating an environment in which new conflicts can develop almost imperceptibly. Paragraph 207. This, then, is the fertile ground for new wars that are perhaps more dangerous than those of the past, since they tend to disregard all ethical limits. What was once considered unacceptable can now be carried out almost without hesitation, while the international response is increasingly influenced more by the interests of individual governments than by the objective gravity of situations. Decisions now seem to be driven almost exclusively by economic calculations, justified through media distortions, manufactured enthusiasm, and dreams that inevitably shatter, generating frustration and further violence. When people come to believe that nothing is genuinely true and that principles are hollow words, then the fuse in their hearts is lit for new eruptions of intolerance and aggression. Paragraph 208. In these situations, the issue of concrete safeguards to prevent future violence remains an open question. When a culture normalizes and justifies conflict, a dangerous pathway opens up, and that what seems unacceptable today may become acceptable tomorrow in the name of utility or security. In countries marked by serious social tensions, we cannot rule out the possibility that some leaders may consider armed conflict as an effective way of diverting attention from domestic problems and a cynical tool for managing difficulties. Paragraph 209. A particular responsibility rests on the shoulders of those who work in the field of research. All of the key players in this field, scientists, business owners, investors, academic authorities, politicians, and others, must work with a transparent and responsible mindset, while maintaining an acute awareness of the broader context of the technological advancements they help to cultivate, including those related to AI. When people limit themselves to looking only at their own sector, they may deceive themselves into believing that they are performing actions that are morally neutral and avoid questions about the ultimate ends that guide certain experiments. In this way, they risk cooperating, perhaps unknowingly, with questionable projects that fuel new forms of violence, manipulation, and dominance. Building the civilization of love. Paragraph 210. The construction of a world in a state of perpetual conflict is an evil and must be named for what it is. This way of portraying our current situation may seem bleak or pessimistic, yet I consider it necessary to do so. The Christian perspective, however, is not limited to denouncing evil. We view history in the light of the crucified and risen Lord, to whom the Father has given all authority in heaven and on earth. We do not consider the present as a predetermined fate, but an opportunity for personal and collective conversion. Moreover, we believe in the power of the kingdom, which grows from the tiny size of a mustard seed, which, once sown, sprouts and grows. While the tumult of confusion is all around us, goodness grows silently from the earth. In the words of the prophet Isaiah, "Behold, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it?" Paragraph 211. A closer analysis of conflict confirms this. Even in the darkest nights, the Lord raises up men and women who refuse to give up, who persevere in doing good, who protect the vulnerable and open pathways to reconciliation. The memory of the saints, righteous people, and the oft-forgotten peacemakers show us that grace does not magically eliminate conflict, but instead it inspires active resistance to evil and an astonishing creativity in doing good. Christians see the darkness and acknowledge it for what it is. Yet they do not merely gaze upon it passively, for they know the light and understand that the darkness has not overcome it and cannot defeat it. For this reason, even when suffering seems to have the last word, Christians serve the good and are sustained by a theological hope that gives reality both meaning and direction. We can all do our part. Paragraph 212. At this point, however, a subtle temptation may emerge, namely the thought that the problems are too big and we're too small, and that our choices, therefore, cannot make a difference. This is a polite form of resignation, often disguised as realism. Certainly not everyone has the same power to make a difference. There are those who govern, make investment decisions, lead institutions, conduct research, educate, produce, or provide information. And then there are those who only seem to live their daily lives. Yet no one is without responsibility. We all have our own areas for action, and it's precisely there, and nowhere else, that we must choose whether to fuel the mentality of force, even if only through indifference, cynicism, lies, or hatred, or to preserve the mindset of peace, with truth, moderation, closeness, and care. Paragraph 213. The 20th century Catholic author J.R.R. Tolkien, in the words of a protagonist in one of his novels, described our responsibility in this way. It is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. The civilization of love will not arise from a single or spectacular gesture, but from the sum total of small and steadfast acts of fidelity that serve as a bulwark against dehumanization. For this reason, it's worthwhile pausing to reflect on some aspects of how we, each in our own way, can cooperate in building the civilization of love. Without presuming to exhaust this theme, I would like to propose five paths toward daily and public responsibility: the need to disarm words, building peace through justice, adopting the perspective of victims, cultivating a healthy realism, and reviving dialogue and multilateralism. The need to disarm words. Paragraph 214. The first contribution we can make toward a more humane civilization is to be mindful of our words. Let us disarm words, and we will help to disarm the world. Words have enormous power, something we experience in our daily interactions. For example, spoken words can change our mood for better or for worse. Peace begins with each one of us. In the way we look at others, listen to others, and speak about others. In this sense, the way we communicate is of fundamental importance. We must say no to the war of words and images. We must reject the paradigm of war. We must all, therefore, examine our conscience regarding the words we use, the prejudices we have, and the explicit or implicit aggression that lies within them. We have a real opportunity to contribute to the common good each time we speak the truth, offer wise advice, support those in need of comfort, denounce injustice, and give a voice to the voiceless. Building peace through justice. Paragraph 215. All of us at every level can contribute to building the foundation of peace, which is justice. We do not merely seek any kind of peace, such as an absence of conflict at any cost, but instead the true peace born of justice. There exists a very close connection between the justice of the individual and the peace of everyone. Commenting on the psalm verse, "Justice and peace have embraced," St. Augustine wrote, "There is no one who shuns the desire for peace, yet not everyone is willing to practice justice. But perform the works of justice, keeping in mind that justice and peace have embraced. They are not at odds with one another. Why do you set yourself against justice? Here, for example, is justice telling you not to steal, but you pay no heed, not to commit adultery, but you turn a deaf ear, not to do to others what you would not want done to yourself, not to say about your neighbor the things you would not want said about yourself. Do you therefore wish to attain peace? Then practice justice. Let us never grow weary of seeking justice." Adopting the perspective of victims. Paragraph 216. There are times when, in order to remain human, we must set aside our reservations and take a stand. In some conflicts, it's unjust to remain neutral, nor is it enough merely to claim that we are not complicit. When we witness the bombing of civilians, attacks on hospitals, schools, or vital infrastructure, and violence that affects children, we are confronted with scandals that wound humanity itself. For this reason, we cannot limit ourselves to the level of abstract analysis. Pope Francis encouraged us to touch the wounded flesh of those who suffer, look at their faces, listen to their stories, and acknowledge their wounds. Painful events require both history and memory, the former to recount the facts, the latter to bear witness to lived experiences. Paragraph 217. Giving space to the perspectives and voices of victims through communication and education helps us to become aware of the abyss of evil inherent in war, and generally in all forms of violence. It helps us to reject the normalization of conflict, not to turn away when human dignity is violated, and to restore to victims the dignity of being recognized and heard. Paying attention to these voices strengthens the conviction that, apart from violent minorities, humanity does not desire war. In a particular way, the church can be a place of living memory for victims. As St. Paul VI recalled, the church feels she must make her own both the voice of those who died in past wars and the voice of the living who still bear wounds today, so that their cries may become an appeal for peace and harmony and not a prelude to new conflicts. Cultivating a healthy realism. Paragraph 218. We are in need of a healthy realism that avoids both political idealism and cynicism. This is a kind of idealism that, in order to preserve its own worldview, tends to choose facts selectively, distorting and renaming them. Its proponents eventually inhabit a reality constructed to fit their own convictions. Conversely, there is also a debased form of realism that confuses observation with resignation, arguing that since force prevails, it will always prevail. Authentic realism does not give up on changing the world. Indeed, it starts by clearly identifying interests, fears, constraints, and power dynamics, precisely in order to determine that what can be achieved and the measures needed to achieve it. It does not reduce politics to morality. Neither does it surrender to violence. Instead, it seeks viable paths for making peace more than a mere word, through credible institutions, verifiable guarantees, patient negotiations, conflict prevention, and the protection of civilians. Reviving dialogue. Paragraph 219. In order to build the civilization of love, we must engage in dialogue, for this is the primary means of coexistence between people and nations, and it's the alternative to open conflict. On the eve of the Second World War, Pius XII affirmed that nothing is lost with peace, whereas with war, everything can be lost. He insisted that people must return to speaking with one another, because a sincere and persevering dialogue always opens up the possibility of an honorable solution. Paragraph 220. Indeed, dialogue is an ordinary part of human life and does not only concern relations between states. It involves acquiring an attitude that seeks to forge bonds of fraternity built on listening, an open demeanor, making time for each other, and even wasting time together. For if we experience authentic encounters with others, with those who are different, strangers and migrants, it becomes much more difficult even to imagine war. Paragraph 221. At the political level, there's an urgent need to shift from the culture of power to a genuine culture of negotiation, in which dialogue and diplomacy become the standard means of resolving conflicts. Giorgio Lapira expressed the hope that the method of war be replaced by the method of peace, the method of negotiation, of encounter, of convergence, that is, the authentically human method. The awareness that all peoples share a common future demands that the culture of negotiation become an increasingly shared political and cultural commitment, capable of gradually leading humanity away from the cycle of violence. Paragraph 222. To those who have the honor and responsibility of governing, I would like to repeat the words that I spoke at the start of my pontificate. The peoples of our world desire peace, and to their leaders I appeal with all my heart. Let us meet. Let us talk. Let us negotiate. War is never inevitable. Weapons can and must be silenced, for they do not resolve problems but only increase them. Those who make history are the peacemakers. not those who sow seeds of suffering. Our neighbors are not first our enemies, but our fellow human beings. Not criminals to be hated, but other men and women with whom we can speak. Let us reject the Manichaean notions so typical of that mindset of violence that divides the world into those who are good and those who are evil. Paragraph 223. In rejecting the mindset of violence, interreligious dialogue plays a decisive role because at the heart of the great spiritual paths lies a message of peace. Whereas those who use the name of God to legitimize terrorism, violence, or war betray his true nature, for to fight in the name of religion means attacking religion itself. The spirit of Assisi, evoked by St. John Paul II and carried forward by Pope Francis, for example, through his dialogue with the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, shows that believers can draw upon the most authentic sources of their spiritual traditions, where there is no room for sanctified hatred. The necessity of diplomacy and multilateralism. Paragraph 224. In international relations, dialogue is an irreplaceable diplomatic tool for preventing conflicts and rebuilding bonds of trust. Faced with the impulsive broadcasts, aggressive rhetoric, and power politics that characterize our time, the vocation of diplomacy is to foster dialogue with all parties, including those interlocutors considered less convenient or not considered legitimized to negotiate. Therefore, every ounce of humility and patience should be employed in order to nurture even the faintest signs of goodwill among parties in conflict, so as to advance the process of peace. Paragraph 225. Cyberspace, too, has become a battleground. Cyber attacks, data manipulation, and campaigns of influence, orchestrated with the help of AI, can destabilize entire countries even before armed conflict erupts. Moreover, in this area, the attribution of responsibility is often uncertain. When it's unclear who carried out an attack, the risk of disproportionate reaction, miscalculation, and escalation increases. For this reason, diplomacy must be capable of operating effectively in this new environment, negotiating shared regulations on the use of digital technologies in order to protect civilians and the most vulnerable from invisible yet real forms of violence. Paragraph 226. International organizations, particularly the United Nations, are essential instruments for promoting a civilization of love, for they can foster dialogue among nations and promote the peaceful resolution of conflicts, the integral development of peoples, the protection of the most vulnerable, disarmament, and the care of creation. Through such efforts, the international community can work to reduce inequalities, defend the rights of refugees and minorities, reallocate resources from military spending to human development, and protect our common home. The Holy See supports and accompanies these endeavors, while also recognizing that the current weaknesses of the UN and the international political system reveal the need for profound reforms. This is not simply a question of technical adjustments, for the crisis of convictions and values that also concerns the ethical foundations of nations makes it more difficult to direct multilateralism toward the true common good. Paragraph 227. In the international context, the Holy See's diplomacy adopts the gospel's principle of mercy as a concrete criterion for political action. This is one of the ways in which the Holy See places itself at the service of humanity, thereby appealing to consciences in the name of charity and truth, defending the dignity of every person, and speaking up on behalf of the poor, migrants, and victims of war. In this way, papal diplomacy expresses the Catholicity of the Church and contributes to the building of a civilization of love, where even new technologies can be oriented toward the common good. Praying and hoping. Paragraph 228. These avenues for exercising responsibility are sustained by prayer, and in turn nourish prayer. Indeed, for each of us, peace primarily comes from God, God who loves us all unconditionally. It's a gift given by Jesus to his disciples on the day of Easter. Peace be with you. It is the peace of the risen Christ, a peace that is unarmed and disarming, humble and persevering. With these words, I greeted the church and the world on the day of my election to the See of Peter. I wish to repeat them now and to invite everyone to pray for this gift. let us never tire of praying for peace and of committing ourselves to achieving it in our relationships and in society. Encyclical letter Magnifica Humanitas of Pope Leo XIV on safeguarding the human person in the time of artificial intelligence.